following podcast is for educational purposes only. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Weekly Pulse. My name is Jeff Snyder. I'm the founder of the Morning Pulse and your host for this Weekly Pulse podcast. And joining me on the line is Ms. Natalie Walters from The Motley Fool. She's a tech reporter. Natalie, how are you this morning or this afternoon?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
Glad to be here. Glad to see you. And I think our viewers obviously get a chance to see both of us as we had a little prep session this morning. So hopefully they were able to check out our little preview interview. But you had a good week so far?
Yeah, it's been good. I got back from ice another week, so I'm still adjusting to the light outside and to getting back into work. But it's been good. I feel like I'm fully back now.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you back. The audience is glad to have you back. And I know there's quite a few things you want to talk about. You kind of alluded to this in the promo video we shot about Amazon. And I think when we were talking, you had mentioned that there had been some issues with Amazon Prime Day. So could you bring the audience up to speed and maybe a little analysis as well?
Sure. So if you're not one of the millions of people who shopped on Amazon Prime Day, you may not know that it started on Monday at 3 p.m. and it ran for 36 hours. However, within 15 minutes of the launch of Amazon Prime Day, the site was glitching up and people weren't able to purchase their items, and some weren't even able to see the items that were available. And it was a huge deal and people were very frustrated. You know, a lot of people gave up on trying to buy things, and so people weren't sure if they would hit their targets and things like that. But they were able to have their biggest Prime Day yet. They sold 100 million products in those 36 hours. And Wow. The best-selling products were the Fire TV Stick with the Alexa voice remote and the Dot. And so internal documents yesterday came out about what exactly went wrong on Monday. And apparently Amazon just wasn't prepared for the surge in traffic. It didn't have enough servers. And they had to actually use a backup front page that was, you know, scaled back and put that up for people. And they had to cut off all their international traffic in order to handle. So for a while, only U.S. users could access the site just so they could handle the amount of people in the U.S., much less international. So wow. It's kind of surprising that they weren't able to deal with that. I don't know what you guys think, but it seems like, you know, when they market it so heavily that they would have enough backup servers to handle it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was just thinking that. I think number one, you know, Amazon has cloud services that they provide to the world. And I guess, you know, even a big company or a company that is dealing with in the electronic fields can handle the surge that can potentially happen from these types of shopping events. So, I don't know, you know, how they respond to this. Obviously, they were able to make sales. People were in tune to making sales and logging in. It didn't certainly stop their sales, but, mm-hmm. you know, I wonder what the fallout will be from this.
Yeah, and it's especially problematic when it's glitching because a lot of their deals, you know, only last a certain number of hours. So, you know, if you had planned on getting this one deal right when it launched at 3 p.m., I'm not exactly sure what happened to those deals, but the timing is key. But mm-hmm. I saw another interesting stat when I was looking at Amazon today, and eMarketer, which is, you know, a popular firm that follows tech companies, they think that Amazon will finally have half of the U.S. e-commerce market by the end of 2018, and that's up from 44% last year. So
yeah,
pretty amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, what a difference. You know, I remember reading about Mr. Bezos in business school, and you know, he kind of really stuck through it, and he's built a platform that obviously has had some great success. And the question becomes, which platform? And I know we're going to get into Netflix in a minute, but which platform actually is going to win out? Is it a platform like an e-commerce site like Amazon, where they offer fresh, you know, Whole Foods and you know, purchasing electronic and clothing and also content, or is it something like a Netflix or a Roku? I mean, it really is an interesting conversation, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really impressive. And I'm excited to see what happens.
Yeah. So shifting gears a little bit, there was also some news, a little bit. I mean, we go from e-commerce to just content, but there was some news related to Netflix, I think this week and last week. What's going on there?
Yes, so Netflix missed its subscriber additions target for the first time in 5 quarters. I myself was pretty shocked to see this, which I told you this morning, but they added 647,000 domestic subscribers when they were expecting 1.23 million, and then they added 4.47 million international when they were expected to add 5.11 million. So to kind of sum that up, you know, they missed, and it wasn't just a little miss, you know, it wasn't huge, but it wasn't just a slight miss either. And I think a lot of people were shocked to see that just because there's been so much praise around Netflix in the past year and even 2 years. And so I think that came as a shock, and it's just a good reminder that, you know, every company goes through ups and downs, and no company is ever secure. You know, I think every company has to always be researching their audience, researching how to grow, and putting in the effort to stay up to date, to stay ahead of the competition. And I think if we're looking at maybe why they failed to hit those targets, it could be because of the saturation. They have 57 million subscribers in the U.S. And, you know, they're getting up to about half the households in the U.S. that have Netflix. So it's hard to keep the growth up.
And that's where I interesting and excellent analysis, Natalie. I think, you know, this is when I was going back to the conversation about what platform wins out. You know, obviously content is important. And I think I read somewhere that Netflix spends close to $2 billion. Is that right? On content, or was it $2 billion in marketing? Maybe it was $8 billion on new content for 2018 and 2019. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's great, but to your point, do you get an oversaturation? I mean, how much content can someone consume? I mean, I have been, as we've talked about, I have been binge watched recently Star Trek: The Next Generation. I'm on to the Clone Wars. But you know, some of the new series just don't kind of really get me engaged. And that's just my personal preference. My fiance Jody does like, some other series as well. But you know, the question is, how do you change your strategy, or do you need to change your strategy? And I guess it's up to Netflix to figure that out. And does a strategy like Amazon, where they are an e-commerce site as well as a content provider, does that ultimately look like the real platform of the future and the greater success rate?
Right. For Amazon, you know, if for some reason their content platform ever didn't work out, it's not really a big deal for them because they have so many other services to offer, you know, cloud, music, and obviously their e-commerce site. I think it will be really interesting when Disney launches their platform, and you know, there's other tech companies that are working on video streaming platforms. It'll be interesting to see what people do. Will they buy multiple subscriptions, or will they buy Netflix subscription for 1 month, binge watch everything they want, then buy the Disney subscription for 1 month, watch everything there, you know, kind of switch off? Or will we see more people going to Disney than Netflix? I don't know. It'll just be interesting to see what happens when there's more competition in the space next year.
Well, I guess all we can say is to be continued. I know you really like this tech space and the telecommunication space, Natalie. So I assume that we will, of course, continue the conversation again, same time, no real channel, but same time, same channel next week. So you have a very great weekend.
Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye. Well, that's always a pleasant conversation with Natalie Walters from The Motley Fool. And we've got a great guest joining us. He is the publisher of Governing Magazine, Mr. Mark Funkhauser. Mark, how are you today, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I know you are traveling today in New York, but we thank you for making some time this afternoon to chat with us. And I think what's a really interesting factoid about you, and I want to get into Governing Magazine in 1 minute, is that you served as the 53rd mayor of Kansas City, Missouri. So I think you have an interesting perspective, obviously, from the and as well as publishing brings an interesting perspective to the conversation.
Yes. Interesting is the word for it. I have a PhD in public administration, but that was my real graduate education.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. So just kind of before we kind of get into what's going on at Governing Magazine, could you just to familiarize our listeners and the audience, talk a little bit about Governing Magazine, its mission, when it was founded, just so we have a basis.
Okay, so the magazine is about 30 years old. It was founded in 1987. Its mission is to advance better government through the diffusion of innovation. We started out as simply a print monthly magazine. We still do a print magazine, but we now do events. We have custom publications. We do research on the state and local market and so on. We are the premier magazine media platform really today that covers state and local government. We have about 85,000 subscribers to the print magazine, but we have about 8 million unique visitors to the website annually, and about a million and a half page views a month.
Wow, that's incredible. And, you know, I think as someone who has served as a consultant to the public sector market, I mean, obviously, having information and being able to talk about current trends is so important and so vital to making sure that we keep our cities, counties, and other other entities really in good shape financially, so that they can perform the work that they are intended to do. So, what are some of the trends that you're covering on the pages of your magazine?
Well, some of the things that are sort of top of mind right now, the ongoing series of crises that governments are facing, everything from the tornadoes and wildfires and that sort of thing, to public health outbreaks like the hepatitis A outbreak in San Diego, and civil disturbances, as have followed, for example, in Baltimore and other places after police shootings. There's just a lot of stuff like that, and that's sort of a significant focus. Also, sort of the unfolding affordable housing crisis, which seems to be pretty much everywhere. There's a lot of focus on places like Seattle and San Francisco, yep, but a lot of mid-sized towns that are sort of low income have huge affordable housing problems.
Yeah, we certainly read about that and have heard about that in the mainstream press. And certainly people, affordable housing is very important. We need to make sure, ensure that people have a place to stay. And so I know that governments are working hard along with the private sector to solve that. Is there any work that you're doing on the pages of the magazine related to pensions? I know I've seen you present in the past, and you've facilitated conversations around retirement, but just wondering what maybe some of the latest trends are there.
Well, the pension thing is a big problem that is attracting lots of attention, and the sort of underlying financial fundamentals are frankly not good, because you have fewer and fewer active employees and more retirees, and the retirees are living longer than they used to, and they're bringing a lot of healthcare issues with them. So one of the most sort of recent wrinkles is that the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, GASB, now has OPEB, which is essentially other post-employment benefits or retiree health care. The liability that governments have for that now has to be shown directly on their balance sheet and go straight to what's called the statement of net assets. So it shines a bright light on the essentially the debts that governments have to their retired employees for healthcare. So now the rating agencies and others are stacking together basically three kinds of debt. The regular bonded debt that governments have, the pension debt obligations that governments have, and the retiree healthcare obligations. And they're simply adding those all together. And for a lot of governments, that is a big challenge for them to figure out how to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've talked about on this show, we want to make sure that if people are invested or part of a defined benefit plan that and they're scheduled to get benefits, we've got to figure out a way to solidify or strengthen those retirement plans. But also, you don't want to do it to burden the taxpayers and the citizens, and you also don't want to burden the governments from providing the key services, the core services that they're trying to provide, police, firefighter, and other, basic services. So it really is a juggling act. And I think the other area potentially is, you mentioned in the OPEB, is healthcare, Medicaid, right. Medicaid as well.
Right. Yeah, my current column, I write a column called Better Government for the magazine, and it's also online. And I point out that this is the third longest expansion that we've had. So we're due for another recession at some point. And when a recession comes, while the revenue hit for governments is big, the expenditure hit is actually bigger. And most of it, at least for state government, is healthcare, Medicaid, and so forth. And in fact, a report by Moody's Analytics says that that's sort of the first indicator that a recession is coming, a growth in Medicaid roles and healthcare roles in state governments. For the Great Recession that we had, 2007 and 8, that happened 9 months before the revenue fall that we thought was the recession.
And on top of that, you've got the Affordable Care Act fallout because, you know, there's obviously some rule changes under the new administration that has an impact on healthcare as well. The people are going to be purchasing and whether or not there's a mandate to purchase that healthcare. So, it really is a juggling act. And I feel really, these people at the local level are doing such great work on behalf of their citizens to provide services. But it is a juggling act. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's an easy fix on either side of the equation.
Right. One of the things that we try to do is we look at problems like that. And then we try to find people who seem to be doing better, who are juggling and dropping fewer balls. And then we tell people about them. That's sort of the core of what governing does. And so you mentioned that I'm traveling today. I'm on the road probably at least every other week. I go all over the United States doing roundtables and events and speaking and so forth and so on. And I spend a lot of time listening to state and local government officials, what are their priorities? What are their challenges? That sort of thing. And it gives you a sense of the diversity across this country, of the way that people look at these things, the way they deal with them, not just the red state, blue state thing, but lots of differences even within those.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you have a fascinating role as facilitators, writer, and you see these issues firsthand. And I think we would agree that, case studies, what you're kind of describing as case studies, is important. It presents a path forward, not the only path forward, but a path forward for municipalities and local governments potentially to shore up their own finances. And, that I think is one way to strengthen themselves. But alas, this is not something that's going to be solved over time. And, it's just something that we're going to have to keep our pulse on, especially in light of what's going on with national elections.
Right. Exactly right. Yep.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Hope you had a great trip into Long Island and New York. And hopefully you've had a good experience and you'll be willing to come back to update our listeners on what is going on with state and local governments.
Absolutely, Jeffrey. Yes, I'd be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bud. Well, that was Mark Funkhauser from Governing Magazine on the road and getting great feedback about state and local governments. And our train keeps on running along and really privileged in this segment to be joined by Mr. Kevin Kelly of Bloomberg. How are you today? Oliver Rennick is off today. He is attending his brother's bachelor party. His brother's getting married, so we wish Oliver the best, and I'm sure he's behaving. So, Kev, it's been an interesting week. I think we had 5 days recently of positive gains. I think yesterday we did not have as good a day as we had in the market. But what are some macro themes that you're seeing and Bloomberg are seeing in this economy, in this market?
Yeah, for sure. So it's been a good run so far. I mean, you're starting to see some strength come back to the market. I think, you know, again, just to reiterate, people have gotten so caught up in this recent kind of correction in equities. But when you take a step back and you look, you know, longer term, over the last, you know, 2 years or so, when you really had this period of volatility creep up in late 2015, early 2016, there's a lot of the same rhetoric going around that, you know, you're going to have this slowdown in China, that global growth is going to come to a halt, you know, kind of setting volatility in equities. And then, you know, as we know, the market just kept moving higher, with 2017 being just a pretty much a straight shot up with a very, very limited volatility. So I think we're starting to get some more good economic data coming through that should help continue to support this robust earnings outlook here in the U.S. Earnings drive stocks. We've talked about that before. That outlook looks really good with 2Q, the second quarter kicking off this week. The only, you know, other notable I would say that we've been watching for is obviously trade. I'm sure we'll get into some of the trade talk, especially with Trump going on another tweet storm this morning. And that's going to, I think that's going to continue to have some really interesting implications, not only just the dollar amount that he's projecting to slap tariffs on, but I think what it also means for other countries. I believe in a prior segment, you guys had talked to Ms. Hooper, who had mentioned, and I've been following her stuff for a while from Invesco, she mentioned the implications for this being kind of a tit-for-tat trade war. But what does it do for other countries outside of, you know, the U.S.-China trade talk now? And what you can see is that other countries, especially in the European Union, Japan, they had meetings this week to discuss different trade, potential trade agreements. So you might end up seeing a lot of these other countries kind of band together under a common enemy, so to speak, being the U.S., which is certainly something that, you know, we haven't really seen, you know, especially recently with this more, you know, free trade, open market policy. So, I mean, that's what's really interesting. And there's a lot of uncertainty surrounding exactly what that would look like, what those trade agreements would look like. But it could longer term definitely have some pretty adverse effects on the U.S. economy and U.S. stocks. Historically speaking, I mean, when you look at foreign holdings of U.S. treasuries, and that's a really good point. It's something I was reading this week, too. And you can kind of relate this to a lot of the talk, again, bringing it back to China, with China being, you know, one of the largest holders of U.S. debt in terms of foreign holders. Historically, its effect on commodity prices really depends, again, on the strength of the dollar, as you mentioned. So what we've seen recently, dollar strength, a lot of it being uncertainty surrounding trade war, a lot of it being, again, this narrative of divergent monetary policy between these, you know, big G10 nations. So you would continue, or you would expect to see a dollar strengthen where we're raising rates and other places around the world, i.e. Europe, China, Japan, excuse me, are not. And so if you see the dollar continue to strengthen, that'll pressure commodity prices. That'll have a bigger, I would expect that to have a bigger impact necessarily than, you know, Russia or China selling off some of their U.S. treasuries or U.S. debt. What that'll do is potentially put pressure on yields to move higher, which, again, could choke off some of this good economic data, some of this good growth that we've been seeing. So that's kind of an indirect effect, I guess you could say. But it certainly could have some pretty broad implications for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think we saw that with the passage of the tax reform that we had at the end of the year and into 2018. What was going to be the impact of that? And I think, you know, people are pursue their own self-interest to get a little Milton Friedman on everyone. And, you know, people want to know how all these things impact them. We've got, the Federal Reserve announcing that, you know, talking about raising rates and keeping a steady interest rate progression. And I think people just really want to understand, because they want to understand what it's going to mean to their pocketbooks both today and in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, like, just one more quick point on that is,
sure,
this is a market that's, especially here in the U.S., when I'm talking about the stock market, that's extremely dependent now on earnings growth rather than multiple expansion. What I mean by that is, when you hear people talk about valuations being very high, you've heard it a lot about the FANG names, the tech sector, which is a little bit of a misconception because the tech sector is not too expensive, but neither here nor there. When you hear these general kind of valuations are high, how can they go higher? How can the stock market go higher? you know, our big thesis this year and why we think, you know, stocks can remain pretty supported at these levels is we expect this really robust, as I mentioned, earnings outlook and earnings growth moving forward on the back of some of the stronger economic data. And what the potential implications from a lot of the White House rhetoric could have on that is if you start disrupting supply chains, if you start slapping on tariffs and making imports more expensive, if you really do anything to interrupt that robust global growth outlook or opportunity for U.S. earnings to expand, then you start to get into this argument of, are valuations actually too high because we now have a slightly less or significantly less, depending on how big these tariffs are, how big the effects are, expectation for earnings moving forward. So, again, a very earnings-dependent market, and any interruption or disruption to that could certainly weigh on stock prices, which, again, U.S. equities make up such a large part of the global market, global equity market, that it would have, you know, really big implications on everybody who, you know, from the individual stock picker who holds something like Apple to people's 401ks that have a large portion, you know, allocated to the U.S. equity market.
Yeah, absolutely. And one, I want to get your sentiment. In one of our previous segments, we had Natalie on to talk about, I don't want to talk about individual securities, but you mentioned the tech sector, Kev. And just curious what the take is on some of these missed subscriber numbers and what that potentially means, or, you know, does it mean anything?
Yeah, it's what I really like about the tech sector and how it's evolved, you know, over the last few years is the traditional analyst models for how you would project out earnings or even cash flow are kind of being turned on their head with these, again, as you mentioned, subscriber numbers and these more alternative data sets. So, again, you need to see some really strong expansion for a lot of these companies. And if there's any weakness there, especially in the international markets, which has like been one of the biggest pushes for a lot of these tech, the tech sector growth outlook, if you see any weakness there, then that certainly could help, could hurt the sector. But I think what's a positive catalyst is that I think it's a misconception that this market, especially that tech sector, is really only being driven by a handful of names, you know, all the names that we routinely hear on, you know, the CNBCs of the world. But I would say that there, and we've done some work on this in not only the small cap space, but even across like large cap tech, you do see a pretty wide dispersion and strengthening across the board in some of these names. So there are a lot of interesting smaller companies in the tech space that do have a good fundamental outlook, aren't crazy expensive in terms of valuation multiples like we were just talking about. So I think, you know, one thing to note is that there are definitely still opportunities within the tech sector, and tech being over 25% of the S&P 500, it's obviously a behemoth, and it's very important for the market to move higher in general. But there is a lot of opportunity outside of those names that I think often gets overlooked because there's just so much, you know, media attention and scrutiny on some of these bigger names.
Always a pleasure chatting, and I think Oliver will be back next week, so we'll have the three amigos back on. Well, that should be really interesting. And two points. The first is, I'm surprised you mentioned CNBC, being that you work for Bloomberg, Kevin, but I love that spirit of camaraderie that you just mentioned. And I forgot to mention that everything that we're talking about on this segment of the show and the show in general is for educational purposes, and that we're not providing any investment guidance to anyone. This is just for interesting conversation and education. So with that, thank you. Have a wonderful weekend, and looking forward to the trifecta reappearing next week. I'm scared.
Looking forward to causing some trouble.
Well, that was another great, interesting segment with Kevin Kelly from Bloomberg. And now we're going to turn our attention to retirement and retirement coverage. And we're very privileged to have on with us the state treasurer from California, Mr. John Chung. Treasurer Chung, how are you, sir?
I'm doing excellent. Very excited to spend this time with you.
Well, thank you so much. And we have been covering on the show for the last several months, providing coverage. It's our mission to communicate to people around the United States about covering themselves for retirement, financial independence. And you and the folks in California have been working so hard on what's called the Cal Savers program. But before I get into Cal Savers, could you start by telling us the problem as you see it in the great state of California?
Well, it's a growing issue not only in California, but throughout the United States of America. When you look at the historical three-legged stool, individual savings, a company provided retirement plan and Social Security, we see the legs of the stools being shortened, if not entirely eliminated. We know that about half of Americans don't have money saved for their retirement. We have, unfortunately, a significant population of California workers who are on a trajectory to retire into economic hardship, especially when you bring to bear the fact that California is a high cost of living state, with despite the fact that we're the world's fifth largest economy, one in every five Californians live in poverty. And so we need to make sure that we provided tools and opportunities so that California's workers have an opportunity to live their later years in the traditional sense, to have them have golden years. But it's going to take a lot of hard work.
Amen. I mean, you are speaking our language, as I mentioned at the outset. I mean, having people being able to save is so critical. And the stats you you mentioned are actually staggering, but consistent with what we have heard with some of the other guests we've had on. So you all within the state created CalSAVERS. So would you be so kind as to kind of go through what CalSAVERS actually is, how it's going to work?
Yeah, CalSAVERS is the largest Social Security. We have 7.5 million California workers who do not have a retirement plan offered by their employer. We know that the employers are have a whole host of reasons, whether it's the administrative fees or the fiduciary responsibilities or the ability to compete in a global economy, so that they don't provide their workers a retirement plan. But we also know, on the other hand, that if you provide an opportunity to workers to save, they're 15 times more likely to save for their retirement. And so we had some forward-thinking public policy makers who wanted to make sure that we change the direction for many Californians, instead of a retirement of poverty, a retirement where there is some type of security. CalSAVERS provides for a automatic deduction for savings. We're looking at setting up at a 5% deduction and ramping that up with every year. This is a program that is no cost to the taxpayers of California, which was a concern by some conservatives and those on the right who didn't want the state to partake in such a program. One of the good things about the CalSAVERS program is it impacts the barriers to employers, that there's no fees on employers. There's no fiduciary liability for the employers. There's very limited administrative role for the employers. We're very excited about the progress that we're making, because we do want to see a rainbow that shines brightly for Californians.
Absolutely. And this is not, I think you alluded to this, but this is not something that overnight you just flip a switch. I mean, there is a process, a lengthy process to pass the legislation, but then you have to go through a process to select your partners, in a sense, the third party administrator. So at this point, what's the status of implementation?
So we want to go out by the end of this year with our pilot program, and then we're going to have a phased roll-in with larger employers participating at the beginning, and then moving to smaller employers. But the exciting part is that we went out for a request for proposal. We had a robust response in regards to those who want to participate in the program. And so we're going to keep chugging along. And the day where the lights are turned on, so that the employees get to participate and benefit is soon.
Absolutely. California obviously is the largest state in the United States. Obviously, we all know this. But do you see this as a solution that other states, I've talked to, as I mentioned, I've interviewed some other people from other states, and I think one of the things that they have taken away from the process is, hey, are there lessons to be learned along the way from what other people, meaning other states and cities, because we have cities in New York and in Seattle that have adopted something similar. Are there some lessons learned? So do you see this as a solution potentially that other states could adopt?
We sure hope so. We think, we need to rebuild that foundation for financial stability and growth for American families. So we were very excited to be the first state to pass legislation in this area. Others have moved forward and started to implement the programs. Kudos to Oregon and Illinois. We've worked very closely with the other jurisdictions. And, you know, at the end of the day, you have a lot of very concerned policymakers, leaders in the private sector, NGOs, nonprofits, who want to see their fellow human being provided with the dignity and decency in their retirement years.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to shift gears a little bit. Thank you so much, and best of luck on the adoption of the and implementation of the new system. I want to shift gears a little bit because I know that you you do sit as an active board member on both CalPERS and CalSTRS. Those are the big pension programs for the audience in California. Want to get your sense of companies that take an active stance on employees and organizing. In your work as a board member, how do you see that?
We've been pushing, and I've especially been pushing on making sure that we have better responsible contracting policies. We represent our employees. They want to see fairness in the process. It's part of our values. We want to enhance, ESG. We want to see better governance practices, and it's borne out in many different respects that when you have better governance policies, you can enhance performance. Oftentimes, people are engaged in battles. It can be dislocating in regards to all the energy, the effort, the resources. We think it's time that we set standards, we set enforced values so that we have better practices, that we can have some of the people that we invest in serve as models of positive behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and what I like is that, it's an outstretched hand. You're extending a hand, you're having a conversation, and I think that's obviously an important start. There's so much negativity, not necessarily around this, but I mean, there's a lot of negativity that we all deal with, and it's nice to have people just, hey, let's sit down and have a conversation, and let's work on behalf of employees that may be in the retirement plan. Kind of shifting gears a little bit, you've, not you particularly, but the board has taken some hardline stances on some investments, pension fund investments in retailers and wholesalers, just in light of some of these horrific events in Parkland, Florida, and workers in San Bernardino. Just want to get an update, your thoughts about this and what you're looking to accomplish as a board, as a group.
Yeah, well, California took a strong stance years ago against investments in the manufacturers of banned weapons. And so I took that a step further and making sure that we wanted to send a clear signal that we didn't want to invest in the suppliers of these banned assault military weapons. And so I brought individuals from the Las Vegas shooting, from the San Bernardino shooting, graduates, Parkland alumni to testify. And so the plants have been engaging with some of the companies, and, we wanted to make sure, I want to credit my colleagues at CalSTRS for supporting a process where we would engage, and then if these companies did not divest, we would look at taking even stronger action. And so we're making a good, positive progress, and so we're going to continue to engage to make sure that California, put its money where its mouth is take it to where it impacts people in the pocketbook.
I love the fact that you're mission driven, and to that end, you've also been a strong voice for corporate diversity. Why is that? I mean, I think the audience knows, but just for the, you know, for the show, why is this?
You know, America is a very special place. We have extraordinary diversity. We have people, including my parents, who sacrifice a lot, who come to this country, who have contributions, who have connections. And unfortunately, we have private sector leadership that can be, I think, a little narrow in their thinking. In, you know, generations ago where you had, you know, all men run cosmetics companies, you know, with great respect, you need people who have a better sense of product, you know, who offer different perspectives on many metrics. When you diversify corporate boards, you have, you see enhanced performance. So why wouldn't we take advantage of young people who have great technology expertise? Why wouldn't we take advantage of women who are over 50% of the workforce, who are substantial purchases with massive purchasing power? Why wouldn't you take advantage of surging emerging populations, whether they come from Latin America or Asia? Let's just make sure that we're fielding the best talent. Our corporations need to think like those in the music industry, or certainly on the competitive athletic field, where people are reaching to Japan, to the Dominican Republic. You know, there's amazing talent everywhere. So let's do a better, thorough assessment of getting the best talent, skills, knowledge onto private sector boards so that we can enhance performance. I need those returns so that I can protect the beneficiaries of the hardworking public servants here in the state of California.
Well, best of luck to you, and thank you so much for joining us on the show today. And we wish you also the best with the implementation of the Cal Savers plan. And I hope you had a great time today on the show, and hopefully maybe you would like to come back as you get further along on the implementation.
I will. I did. I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity and spotlighting the important financial information that transforms lives. So thank you for your service.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too. Be well. Bye-bye.
Well, that was a great, wonderful segment with California State Treasurer John Chung, and talking about CalSAVERS and some of the divestment initiatives going on in CalPERS and CalSTRS. So we're going to turn the attention now to personal finance, and I'm very privileged to be joined by our MarketWatch duo of Mr. Jacob Passy and Ms. Alessandra Melito. Guys, how are you today?
We're great. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Happy Friday to you both, and happy post-Amazon Prime Day.
Yes, we survived.
Yeah, everyone survived. Amazon apparently survived, too. We were talking to Natalie Walters earlier, and I know there were some major issues with the website. But I know there's a lot other than Amazon going on in the wonderful world of personal finance, and you all write some great articles during the week. Let's start with you, Jacob. You had written a story on renters and 5 million renters who may have lost some money in rental scams. So what happened there? I'm a little concerned because I rent.
Yes. So so there was a report that came out from Apartment List, a real estate website, that found that, yes, over 5 million renters have lost money in a rental scam. And they actually estimated that, and this was based on a survey they did, that around 43% of all renters have encountered some form of a suspicious or fraudulent listing during their housing searches. So so basically, you know, rental scams can take different forms. A lot of them are, you know, they're, a lot of times you'll come across these, you know, gorgeous photos on Craigslist, social media, elsewhere online of an apartment or house available for rent. What's going on, and you'll see this great price, and what's actually going on in a lot of these cases is someone has taken, you know, a listing for somewhere that's, you know, available for sale or being rented out by another company and replaced all the contact information. So it'll look like a real place that you can tour. Sometimes people, you know, renters will even tour these places and be like, great. And then they'll give over their money and then find out later that it's a scam. Other scams
can involve, you know, bait and switch tactics where they'll advertise one property and then you'll find out that the lease you signed was actually for, you know, the property next door that isn't as nice, or they'll tell you there are all these amenities that don't actually exist in the end.
Wow.
So there's lots of different tactics that scammers use, and a lot of people can lose significant money either in the form of, you know, giving over, you know, deposits, giving over application fees, things like that, background check fees, supposed fees, I should say, because obviously the people in question who are collecting these fees aren't using them for their intended purposes. So it's a major issue. It affects young people more disproportionately, which isn't terribly surprising because, you know, younger adults are more likely to be renters. They're less likely to be homeowners. So nearly 1 in 10 renters under the age of 30 had lost money to a rental scam. And, you know, you think of young renters, you know, you think of young people being, you know, more tech savvy and things like that, but they're not as good at necessarily identifying fraud or recognizing fraudulent situations. And also, you know, there are lots of cases like, you know, if you're moving to a new city, sometimes you have to, you know, rent an apartment or house sight unseen. And, you know, that leaves you open to these situations where people are scamming you out of money. That's something that happened in Florida just last month. A big rental scam was uncovered where around 18 families had paid money to these two people who claimed to be the landlords for a property when they were in fact not the owners of that property. And they stole more than $25,000 from those families in the fees, supposed fees they were collecting. And one of the families indeed was moving from Indiana, had packed up all their belongings into a U-Haul, showed up to the house and got there the same day as a bunch of other families. And they all kind of realized, wait a second, this is a scam. So it does happen, but there are ways to avoid it. A lot of it is just doing your due diligence. You know, never trust anyone who tells you that you have to wire them money. The FTC actually called this the surest sign of a scam. Money wires are not different than cash. So, you know, if you send a money wire and the person who received it is not the person who they said they were, there's no way to get those funds back. It's just like handing over a bunch of cash to someone. Mm-hmm. There's no recourse. And also, you know, it's important to meet people in person as much as possible. That's not necessarily foolproof either, but, you know, it's definitely better than doing something sight unseen. And also checking out the property in person, researching the property like online to make sure that it's not, you know, avoid these situations where they just copied another listing. If you can find out if the apartment or home is run by is managed by a rental agency or a property management company, find that information out in property search records. Double check that all the amenities that were listed in the listing are listed on the lease. So you don't run into situations where they said, oh yeah, this apartment comes with this gorgeous new refrigerator, and then you show up move-in day and it's not there anymore. Also just remember, it sounds silly, but if it's something is too good to be true, it quite likely is. In this day and age when real estate prices are so high, there are tons of people looking for bargains, and you certainly want to find the cheapest apartment you can. I'm not necessarily encouraging people to spend more money than they can afford or anything like that, but if something looks outrageously cheap, there's possibly a reason it is, and that reason could be that it's a fraud.
It's sad that we've come to this point, but I wonder, Ali, how much of this is financial literacy? How much could that play a role in this? And I know one of the stories that you wrote about this week is about high schoolers and financial literacy, what they've learned and how that applies possibly to retirement. So what say you on that topic?
Oh, so I definitely think that, first of all, financial literacy is not taught in most schools. And if it is, it's like maybe one course or like one day in class. I think that if this was taught in school, then maybe there wouldn't be so many rental scams. So that's the sad point. So I wrote a story about some of the
some of the financial lessons that students should know before leaving high school, but probably don't. Just as a background, U.S. schools rarely incorporate personal finance into their curriculum. And I think, so the statistic is only 16.4% of the 13 million high school students across the country in 2017 were required to take a personal finance course to graduate. 16.4.
Wow.
So that's not a lot.
No.
So I round up some lessons that they should know. One is to save, which a lot of parents tell their kids, you know, save the money, but also to invest or at least know the difference between the two. This can help them down the road when they have big financial goals like buying a house or even retirement. Just knowing the difference between saving and investing and compound interest and how they can earn money if they are passive about it. And, you know, some might even be interested in actually managing money down the road from doing something like that. Another big one is student loan options. A lot of high school kids go to college and they need to get loans out, but it would be really helpful for these students if they were taught the different types of loans that are available, like subsidized versus unsubsidized, and learned about like different interest rates and how this is going to impact them down the road. I think if they were to see the figure of what it would be like when they got out of college, or what it would be like when they were 30 or 35 or even 40, it might have an impact on the loan that they choose, or like how they choose a loan, or even the types of schools that they go to. So I think that's something that has become a major problem, especially considering the country's student debt limit level, sorry, just hit $1.5 trillion.
Oh my. So oh my. Yeah. I mean, I think you guys are like, you're making me depressed a little bit between the rental story and the fact that financial literacy, I think you said less than 20% of people taking or kids taking a class in high school. We're often talking on the show about financial literacy and financial wellness and people saving. And if you don't have a good background in terms of understanding the core concepts, you know, you're actually waiting till after college or when you first start working. I mean, that's a huge learning gap.
Yeah, definitely. And there are so many ways that, you know, a personal finance class could help students when they got into the real world. I mean, it would definitely help them in college, aside from student loans, just the idea of like credit cards versus debit cards and paying off your credit. One of the biggest myths that a lot of people believe is that you shouldn't pay off your credit card, all of your bills, because having some leftover money in your credit card that you didn't pay off will actually benefit your score, and that's not true. And also, I don't think they realize that like what a credit score can do for them down the road, as far as like when they want to buy a car, when they want to buy a house, and all that stuff. And it'll definitely help them when they get to the real world and they're working and they get access to a 401k. Or, you know, then they come into a lot of money. If they come into a lot of money, and there are a lot of issues that tie to personal finance. So it always baffles me that it's not taught in school.
Yeah.
I think for me personally, my teacher spent one class talking about a budget and like making a spreadsheet and teaching me how to write a check, which I personally knew how to do because my parents had shown me that, you know, well before high school, just to like know what it is. But that was the first introduction for a lot of people, and that was just like scratching the surface.
Well, clearly that's an issue, but thank you guys very much for covering two very important issues. It sounds like they're very similar in the issue in terms of the problem. So thank you guys very much. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you again next Friday.
Take
care, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right.
And that was another wonderful segment with Jacob Passy and Alessandra Melito from MarketWatch. And joining us now, it's the Legal Eagles, Kevin Walsh and David Levine from Groom Law Group. Guys, how are you on this Friday afternoon?
Good, good. Thanks for having us on.
Well, thanks for coming by. And, you know, we're going to be the anti-legislation group this week. We're not going to talk about RESA or some of the bills that are talking about it because we've already talked about it. But I know you've got some other very important information for service providers, managers, plan sponsors. You want to talk products today. Is that right?
That is correct. We are going to talk something that we normally don't get into. Sort of what's going on in the market space. What are employers and service providers all talking about themselves? And how is this all relevant?
That's awesome. And just to frame it out for the audience, we're not talking about any particular product or endorsing any particular product. We're just talking about thematic products and what people are yapping about. So without further ado, gentlemen, take it away.
Well, I will say we're endorsing your product, of course.
Well, put I don't really. Aside. Go ahead. Oh, I appreciate that.
I thought we were going to be talking about David Levine's exciting new CIT launch, but it sounds like we're talking about plan products more generally.
We are.
Yes.
So let's talk about it. Let's talk about CIT. Thank you, Kevin. We thought in coming weeks, as we have our conversations, we talk a little bit more about different things that are in the marketplace, because there's a lot of marketing you see out there and what fact, fiction, and in between. So what's gotten a lot of press in the last couple of years have been the rise of collective investment trusts. And they continue their increasing visibility and interest, where mutual funds have been the dominant form, as well as annuities with life insurance companies as well. And they continue to be used in a lot of cases and are great choices in some cases. Anybody who tells you that there's one right or wrong product, there's no one right or wrong for anything. You just have to evaluate. But collective investment trust, let's do a quick basics, and then maybe I'll toss it to Kevin to talk a little about what's going on in the space. Collective investment trusts are not mutual funds, but they kind of feel like it. They're not sort of listed in the old days in the newspaper where you'd get a stock quote, but they function a lot like it. But because they have different legal requirements, their banking regulators who are involved in the collective investment trusts and how they are structured, there's still a lot of regulators overseeing them, but they often have lower costs.
Well, I think they avoid the investment company registration issues.
Yeah. I was trying to keep it simple.
Sorry, I had to complicate it.
But the point is their costs to run are often, not always, but often lower. And because of the cost efficiencies, you've seen them for a long time in the very large jumbo plan market, and you've seen them emerging in the mid and smaller plan market. And a lot of advisors are talking about them, and a lot of people are saying, "Well, this is another thing to think about." And you know what? It really is a good thing to think about. You have to do a subscription agreement usually to participate in them. So it's a little bit the documentation changes. So plan sponsors and fiduciaries may have some questions. But it's a relatively straightforward process, and there are sometimes different rules about when you can get in and out of them, but just like there are in mutual funds. But Kevin, do you want to talk a little bit about how the CITs are not just your old-fashioned black and white? Is it a financial institution, or is it an advisor? It's kind of a blending of all the different things at times at this point.
So I think one of the interesting things about kind of CITs is it's a bit of a history project. It's a bit esoteric, but you look at kind of the development of CITs, and kind of initially the idea was that banks would offer these vehicles essentially as a way that the bank itself could manage the money of one client alongside the money of other clients. So a way that you could collectivize the investment inside of what a bank is holding for you. And over time, we've seen more banks partnering with outside advisors to essentially design these collective investment trust products, where instead of having the bank or an affiliate of the bank be the manager of the money, you now have kind of outside advisors doing it. And what that allows essentially is it's letting outside advisors take advantage of kind of some of the cost savings associated with some of the reduced compliance costs to design and kind of innovate in the retirement space. David, do you want to talk kind of about the different types of products we're seeing offered now?
Sure, absolutely. And there's tons of different products that are out there at this point. I think the most common ones are you see an advisor who may make a multi-manager product where they basically bring in other managers. And there's sometimes where the advisor manages the money themselves. There are sometimes ones where a fund company has created a CIT, and a lot of the big fund groups have. And again, CIT is not always the cheapest. Anybody who says that something is always, we're a bunch of lawyers, so we try to avoid the word. We try to avoid the word always and never, as I just did.
David never says always.
Exactly. More likely than not. But that's the point. It allows different people to play different roles in creating more bespoke products, but also more efficient products, and sometimes just a simpler project. And sometimes the mutual fund's the right answer. There's lots of other things out there that people can use, such as separate accounts and other models that have been developed over time. But these are the ones that are really hot today. So maybe to sum it up for this time, and I'll hand it to you, Kevin, I think is right now, if you're on the service provider side, you very well may be talking about CITs. There are some ins and outs. There are some rules and requirements. Some of the ERISA requirements that apply to them can be complex, and it's important to understand them, because if you make mistakes, you can run into pitfalls. But a lot of people do it well, but it's important to be careful. It is not just a cookie-cutter turnkey that sometimes can get people into trouble, so it's important to be safe. And if you're a plan sponsor or a plan fiduciary, these can really be something worth considering. Is it something you must do? No. Is it something that can add value? Yes. You just have to look at your own facts and circumstances. Kevin, any closing thoughts?
I mean, I think you hit it on the head there with, I think if you're a plan fiduciary, they're a product you're probably hearing about a fair amount as a vehicle that could be offered to your plan participants as a way of saving money. If you're on the advice side, if you're an advisor, if you're kind of a product manufacturer, they're exciting products, and they're kind of the intersection of a handful of laws where you've got the OCC, you've got the Department of Labor, and they raise some interesting advantages in terms of kind of the regulatory structure of the product themselves, and they raise some interesting questions about distribution. So, I mean, CITs they've been around, but they've had a big uptick in usage lately.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you so much. I think the point that you guys made some brilliant points. The one I really want to hone in on for the benefit of the audience, other than the fact that we're not endorsing any particular product set, is that it's important to have the proper due diligence. I think David said that, and I think Kevin said that as well. It's very important if you're a board, a trustee, a fiduciary, any entity considering an investment, you've got to go through a rigorous due diligence process, both in the selection, in the selection and also in the ongoing maintenance of a particular investment product. Because just because you buy it once doesn't mean that, you know, your responsibilities are over. Did I get that right, guys?
You hit the nail on the head. There's pluses and minuses of every product out there and every product design. So we're just highlighting kind of how this one's different than others, but we could equally have a conversation talking about what makes other structures unique and different.
And Jeff, you just gave us an idea for a future discussion of, well, what are people doing to monitor and what should you think about?
I love it. I love it. Well, guys, thank you so much. I want to wish you a wonderful weekend. And we thank you, the audience, thank you for coming on board and chatting about very important topics. So have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
Well, that wraps up a great show. I want to thank our special guest, Mark Funkhauser of Governing Magazine, as well as State Treasurer from California, John Chung. Great stories there, great insights. I also want to thank our wonderful contributors, Mr. George Grombacher from Money Alignment Academy, Natalie Walters from The Motley Fool, Kevin Kelly from Bloomberg, Ali Melito and Jacob Passy from MarketWatch, and of course, David Levine and Kevin Walsh from Groom Law. Everyone was so wonderful, and thank them for donating their time and giving us a great education. So tune in next week. Oh, and I did want to say thank you to our compliance folks. For the benefit of the audience, everything that we do here at The Weekly Pulse is reviewed and evaluated by compliance. And without them, who knows where we would be, quite frankly. So thank you to Matt and Sarah especially. But for The Weekly Pulse podcast, signing off, this is Jeff Snyder. Thank you.